Hi, everybody. My name is Johnny Harris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Johnny.
And I'm glad to be here today, and I'm glad to be sober. I guess I got to tell you, I was born in this town, and this is the scene of the crime. This is where it all started. I had a lot of firsts here. I was born here, and I got arrested here my first time, and I guess I'm one of the earliest people in the world who ever got an out-of-state floater before he was 10 years old. And just, so if any of you people recognize this, don't tell the sheriff that I'm back in town. He may not have forgotten that, but the only thing that I don't know much about is I don't remember much about this town. And I guess it's because my memories of it weren't too swift. I grew up hating alcohol and everything about it because my earliest recollection and memories of it was about alcohol and the things that went on because of alcoholism. And when I came into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 28 years ago last month and said in my early meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people talk to me about being sober, I didn't think you had anything to offer me. And the reason I didn't think that, because I was as physically sober when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as I am right now, as physically sober. And that seemed to be the problem. All my life, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, people told me I shouldn't drink. They told me I shouldn't drink. They told me I shouldn't swallow those pills and smoke that grass and stick those needles in my arm in the latter part of my life. They told me that. And every time they told me that, I was as physically sober as I am right now when they told me. And that was always the problem. My problem was never those things. My problem was always sobriety. Because I'm an alcoholic and I suffer from a disease called alcoholism, and it seemed like to me I've always had to have an answer. Always. Because I was always so confused. I was confused when I was a kid. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand anything that was going on in my life. I was confused about everything that went on. I didn't understand what was happening in life. I didn't understand it. And I had to have an answer for it. I started looking for answers. I didn't understand. Everybody in my family drank alcohol. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And they terrorized this town. They did. They were just it. I mean, they just were real weird people. And I lived around them. And I didn't understand what was going on. I just didn't understand it. I didn't seem to understand why I felt different. And I thought, from time to time, what had really happened to me. I thought I was born beneath my station. I didn't understand what was going on. These people were bad people. I didn't want to be around them. And then what was really confusing in my life was, all of my life, was the things that thought in my head, the things that went on in my head, and the way I felt about these people and the things that went on that I knew I shouldn't be thinking and feeling and doing, but I did. And it was just driving me crazy because I felt guilty about that. I knew I was supposed to feel that way. And I didn't know what to do about it. We used to gather up on the weekends in my grandmother's house, wherever it was. It was around here somewhere. I don't know where it was, but it was around here somewhere. And they'd gather up, and my uncles, I guess they would be king of the mountains that week. I don't know, because they'd whip on one another and steal each other's whiskeys and women and do all that kind of stuff. And whoever won, I guess that was the king for the week. I don't know how they understood that, but see, I could understand with the feelings inside of me why somebody would get somebody down on the ground and kick them. I could understand why somebody would hit somebody with something and turn that violence loose on them. But what was confusing to me was, long about Wednesday or Thursday, they said to one another, "We love one another because we're family." And I guess I said to myself, if that's what family is, you can keep it. And I guess I also said to myself, because I don't ever remember uttering the word prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, if that's what love is, you can keep it too. Because I never uttered the word in my life prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I didn't utter it, because I thought it was a notion of weakness. I thought if you told somebody that you loved them, they had an edge on you and they could use you for it. And you see, people like me don't let people get edges on them. People like me who are takers, we're users and abusers. We're not givers, and we don't let anybody have edges. Takers don't let anybody know what's going on, because takers are just users. And that's the way I lived all my life. I didn't understand that. My grandmother didn't drink. My grandmother just ran around in the kitchen and sang songs to Jesus while they're killing one another down there in the other room. And I didn't understand that, but I thought maybe I should be like Grandma, needing this answer, desperately needing this answer to this business of living. I went where my grandmother went at the first opportunity. And I understand that. My grandmother took me to this place she went to. She went to church. And I had some kind of an idea that I was going to go sit down in this church and be all right. Because I just knew that. I knew if I just went in and sit down, I'd be like my grandmother. But I didn't figure on one little simple thing. That wherever I went, I went. I mean, I don't want you to get too deep in this kind of stuff. I mean, that's about as heavy as I get, folks. But that's the way it works. Wherever I went, I went. I took that rotten attitude of mine with me. That whatever it was that I had, that difference and that belligerence and that arrogance and that hostility and all that stuff, I took that with me wherever I went. And I took it when I left these people that I felt different and strange near them around. I went on the other side of town and sat down with another group of people who were supposed to be good people, and I felt the same way around them. I hated the whole bunch, and I didn't understand that. And I remember sitting in that church a long, long time ago and sitting there waiting for this man to mount a rostrum to tell me why I felt the way I felt and, more importantly, what to do about it. He told me I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, you're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters. And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. I felt very guilty about that. I became frightened of death sitting in that church that day that I was going to be, that people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I didn't know what to do about it. I turned to walk outside the door of the church that day. My old man standing there drunk and hung over, and he tapped me on the head and said, son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me. I don't know what it did to the old man, but I ain't been back to church since, I'll tell you that. Because I didn't want to be like my old man. I didn't want to be like my old man. I hated my dad. I hated him because I lived in a house where drunks work, and it's a frightening place for little kids to live. And in a house like that, in the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture and deathly silence. And that's not the terrible time. The terrible time is when they're out there and they're coming in and you know they're coming in. And I remember that because we lived in a little place about half the size of this room. And my brother and I slept in a little deal over in the corner, a little pallet kind of thing. And when they were out there, the night they were out there, and I knew they were out there and knew they were coming in, I got between my brother and the wall because I thought maybe I could hide there. But it seemed like that he came in and it started, and you know, the fight would start with me and him, and I'd get thrown around the wall and do the things that happened and fit like me. And just the arrogance and the hostility and the violence in me that did it. It wasn't anything to do with him. But I said, I laid there at night and I thought about the things that were going on in my life when they were out there. I thought about my uncles who lived in those penitentiaries and my aunts who worked in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I thought about my old man who beat up my mother who beat up my old man. It dawned upon me one night what the problem was. It was alcohol. They drank and they did those things. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world. I'm going to have something. I'm going to do something and I'm going to be something. But one day I did take a drink. I got into my old man Blue Leg Hooch one day and took a drink of alcohol. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. That stuff went down inside of me and just tore all the madness from me. It took me from the black pit of nothingness, stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living, and installed in me some type of arrogance that said, damn you, world, it's all right. I'm not good enough to be around the good people, but I'm too good to be around the bad people. It's okay right here. I didn't know it at that moment in my life, but what I did, I sold myself into bondage for a feeling. I was never sold into bondage to alcohol. Or to later on the drugs that I used and put in my life. I've sold for that feeling that I got when I put it in my system. And like all false answers, they all quit working. And what happened to me when I drank alcohol happened to me every time I drank alcohol. I took a drink of alcohol and 3 days later they pulled me out from underneath the bridge not very far from here and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later I stood in front of a judge and was sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. That's what happened to me when I drank. Every time I drank, that's what happened to me. I got drunk and went places. Reform school, senior reform school, junior penitentiaries, penitentiaries, and nut houses. Oh, nut houses. This almost reminds me of the nut house. Really. I mean, we used to have to attend group therapy after dinner. And it really gets kind of interesting when you get a dance thrown in afterwards. You know what I mean? That's really what's the Saturday night program in the Nut House. We have dinner, group therapy, and a dance. You know, that's when you'd run into her. You know, whoever she was. But it seemed like to me that they spent that particular time of the day treating me for my illness, and at that time they were teaching me better living through electricity. And that's when she'd shuffle up to me as I'm leaning against the wall, and she'd come over there and we'd engage in meaningful conversation because we were trying to establish a meaningful relationship. Right? And she would say to me, and you'd answer in the tongue of your native tongue, and then she'd finally get her name out, whatever it was, and she'd ask me what mine was. And I'd have to point to my little band on my thing. I didn't know who I was. And although it's a long way from there to where I stand here tonight, and by the grace of God and a miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have missed it all. You know what stands between me and another Saturday night against the wall with no mind left for 3 days because of electroshock treatments? Just a little thought of complacency, that's all. Just a little idea that I've got it made now. I really don't have to do what I used to have to do. And even more important than that is, if this old nemesis of mine that I lived with all of my life when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous comes sneaking back in there, I'm different. I really don't have to do that anymore. I'm this or that or the other, really. I'm really not that bad. I really don't understand that. Being different is the thing that drove me literally crazy all my life looking for an answer. I was always different. Wherever I went, I was different. My mother took me out of that home over there in Hutchinson and took me to California. We got to California. On the way to California, she said, things are going to be different when we get to California. Sure, I thought we'd get a little house with a white picket fence. And, you know, everything would be fine. And we left a one-room shack in Kansas. And we went to California and got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mom got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went on a street corner and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery, my second drink. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing in my life that ever did the same thing twice in succession. I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground, having come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated doing. It went down in there and tore all that madness from me. It took me from there and stood me right there and gave me that. I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. And I spent the next 3.5 years in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. Once a month, my mother come to visit me. She said, I love you and I miss you. When you come home, things are going to be different. Once a month, we went in front of a judge. He sent me to the Whittier State Reform School. My mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed it. And somewhere during that 3.5 year period of time, I switched over and started to believe my mother. I really started to believe her because I wanted so desperately to believe it. I wanted so desperately to believe that the answer to my problem was in a little white house with a picket fence, with a little old lady with a tray full of cookies and milk. I wanted so desperately to believe that. Because, you see, the reason I wanted so desperately to believe that, if that's true, I can do anything I want to do for as long as I want to do it to anybody I want to do it to, live any way I want to live for as long as I want to live, and get me a little white house with a picket fence and be wonderful. See, that's the way I thought. I never had any thought about having to do anything different. I just thought if I could just get it the way I wanted it, it would be all right. So finally one day they went in and they put me in a boys' home in the San Fernando Valley. When I got there, the superintendent told me if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip in 30 days, and God, I was good. 30 days came and went, and he loaded me on an old truck, and he brought me out of the valley, and it was an all-day trip, and he dropped me off in downtown Hollywood. I had to run to catch the old subway cars right downtown L.A. to get off the road and ride down to Willowbrook where I lived. And I got off the ground running 1.5 miles to my mother's house. Around the corner, it's all over now. No more differences, no more apart from. I got to my mother's house, there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed, except me. I'd spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody that used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody you care for them that used to tell me because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that because there was something way down deep inside of me that said that's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. And I went on the street corner and got drunk. I came home next month and got drunk again. Long about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. Sorry, it's the same thing. I'd come home, throw a brick through a window, get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, and get drunk and go back to school. And my first week in school was fine. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. And my second week in school was fine. I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My third week in school, the madness set in because I started to think. I started thinking about showing up in the neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to my gang. My gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what my gang would say if I was to tell them I don't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they would say. But you see, if you're like me, and you're nothing, and you're glued over there against the corner of the wall, you're trying to figure out what that magic thing is that frees you from there and stands you there and gives you this. And the answer comes, it's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. And so you think about tapping a seal on that baby and pouring it down and making that magic happen to you. One day I sit down on the street corner with a gallon of wine and turned it up and drank it. Drank the whole gallon, sober as I am right now. Frightened to death, my magic wasn't magic anymore. And I didn't know what to do about that. The guy tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? He gave me some pills. I thought about that incident many times. And I had never, one time, did I ever remember saying to this guy, what are those? Just what will they do to me? I just went, phew. Thank God they weren't X-Lax. I could start a whole new 12-step program on laxatives anonymous or something. And give you a new thing full of tapes you could have over there. They worked. That's simple. If it worked, they were an answer. But like all false answers, sooner or later, sitting on that same street corner drinking that wine, eating those pills, they quit working. And a guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm and ran running out of institutions because seemingly it worked. It worked for a period of about 4 years. For the last 10 years of my life, I ran around out there in the world trying to find the answer to a hypodermic needle 10 years after it quit working. But the idea in the back of my head, it worked once, it has to work again. See, that's the great dilemma of people like me. In the back of my head, it was sometime, once upon a time, I put something in my system, and all of a sudden life changed and people changed. It wasn't quite so bad. The world was bearable for me to live in for that instant. And when it wasn't in there, the world was unbearable because I was faced with me and the nightmares and the problems and the things I'd done and the havoc I'd created and the people I'd harmed and the blah-blah-blah-blah, on and on and on. And there I am, face to face with me. And I had it with me a long time before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had it for me when I lived here in Kansas. I had it for me when I lived in juvenile hall and penitentiaries and nut houses. I'd had it for me. I'd had it up to here with me for always because I couldn't stand me sober. I couldn't stand my thoughts sober. I couldn't stand the insanity that was going on inside of me sober. That's why I drank. I was crazy, and I didn't understand it. I didn't understand I suffered from a disease called alcoholism because what I was putting in my system, people were telling me was the problem. And the problem was never there when the stuff was in the system. The problem was only there when it wasn't in the system, and I didn't understand that. And I would sit down with these great, brilliant people with their diplomas on criminology and penology and sociology and psychology and psychiatry, and they would say to me, great, wondrous answers. Don't drink. Sure. Don't drink. Obviously, they didn't know what it did. I knew. And I knew they didn't know. A little over 29 years ago. Well, it'll be 30 years ago next month. They tied me down to bed in the Los Angeles County Jail. I didn't know that I was more dead than alive. I weighed 128 pounds and I was yellow. And there was a medical doctor standing at the foot of my bed telling me I was going to die. He left, and all day passed and all night passed. He come bouncing around my room the next morning. He looked out of my bed. He said, son, you're going to die. Nothing we can do for you. And I said, okay. The third day came into my room. I had a terror grip me that I'd never known before since in my entire lifetime. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to have to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again. God knows I didn't want to do that. I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. Now, one night I knew nothing better to do, so I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Oh, God, help me. What a simple little prayer. And you know, there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, "We got an AA meeting down there." Been almost 30 years now. I've lived over 30 years longer than the medical profession said I could live. Over 30 years. From the utterance of that prayer in that deathbed of mine, when God entered into my life, when He came into my life, when I turned my will and my life over to the care of God in that bed, I didn't know I'd done that. Because 2 weeks after I screamed out that prayer in my deathbed, I'm up around a jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on the bed I'd just gotten off of. I didn't know there'd been an intervention in my life. I didn't know God had intervened in my life at all. I didn't know the directions were setting up and I was heading towards you. I didn't know that at all because I didn't get to you right away. I didn't get to you for almost 2 years. I stood in front of a Superior Court judge, was sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. It didn't mean anything to me. I'd been sent to the penitentiary before. He called me a blood-sucking parasite in society. Told me I had no right being around decent people. Told a woman who was sitting in the courtroom carrying my child, if she cared anything about the child, I'd never be allowed to lay eyes on it. And I stood there in full denial, saying, "He ain't talking about me. That's my old man or my uncle or my grandfather or somebody." But he was talking about me. He put into words what I'd always known. Always known. I just never heard it. I always knew. See, I've always known me. I've always known about me. That's part of my dilemma. I'm my own worst judge, jury, and executioner. That's my dilemma. My dilemma is that I know about me. Nobody has to judge me. I judge myself far harsher than anybody else. I condemned me to death when I was 7 years old. I didn't know that. There were no guilty death. I just tried to spend my lifetime trying to destroy me, looking for an answer. I didn't know that. I spent the next 9 months of my life crawling around a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary barking at the moon. A lot of people would have you believe that that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. That's not true. That's where I took me to. There's only one thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life. They kept me alive long enough to live long enough to the fourth day in November 1959 when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all the thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life. They kept me alive long enough to find you. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. On the first Sunday in November 1959, when I wandered into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, was not to get sober. I'm sober as I am right now when I came to my first meeting. I came here because the institution I was in let women come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous over 28 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been hawking and sniffing around here ever since. You got to be careful what gets us sick people in here, I tell you. I moved in and sit down where all people like me sit down. I sit down in the back row with what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have probably froze to death, for God's sake. I didn't know. I'd sit there, I looked up on the back. This is a lot like that. This place that we came to, this meeting we had, was like a big old Quonset hut of a building. One of the more army Quonset huts. It was about this size. It was our mess hall. And I sat way back there, and they had two big A's up on the backboard, and I thought to myself, my God, I wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I don't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. Been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Ringtail Baboon and any kind of an. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what it was, but I didn't want to be one. So I thought I'd wait for these women to tell their racy stories. And they got up and threw me a curve. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't very many young women in Alcoholics Anonymous, young, pretty women. And so these old gals got up to talk and they said they'd drank a long time. You could look at them and know they'd been somewhere for a long time. There's no doubt about that. I know most of you good people are critical when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very sick when I came here. I'm full denial of what I am, and you're just another clown of people. You're just another group. I thoroughly believe that I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because you were another group of people to hate. I had run out of them. There wasn't anybody left. I'd worked on everybody all my life for just a new group. there was something about these people who came to that meeting that day, who drove 185 miles up those old back roads of that penitentiary to talk to us, that I find in Alcoholics Anonymous, in that selected class of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are into action in Alcoholics Anonymous, that selected group of people who are giving of themselves just for the hell of giving it. They're not the spectators or the people who occupy the space in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. They're the ones who are up sweeping the floors and setting up the meetings and doing the things. Those are the ones. These are the ones who had that look about them. They had that twinkle in their eye and that smile on their face and that thing about them that givers seem to get, that takers don't know anything about. Who can recognize it, but to think it ain't for them. They ruined it. They talked about God. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you talked to me about God. I got run out of the room because God was the reason I was. It was not my fault. It had never been my fault. It had been their fault. Now it's God's fault. See, when you run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for your dilemma, you can always blame God for it. He don't talk back. He just doesn't. Listen, you hear him in AA. People talk about him all the time in AA. Guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. I mean, listen to him. God giving people meaningful relationships? I mean, guy told me that one time. He told me about all these meaningful relationships. God gave him, took it away, and I said, "You trying to tell me God's a pimp?" He said, "What?" And I said, "Well, when I did that, they called me a pimp." Oh, God, they get mad at you when you talk about God like that. There's spiritual giants around you. I kept coming back to your meetings long enough and sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous long enough till the miracle happened to me. And the miracle was nothing, no flash of light, no nothing. I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one Sunday a long time ago, and a little guy that I knew stood at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous like this. A little guy did 23 flat years in the penitentiary. Stood at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, told me I didn't have to live the way I'd been living anymore if I didn't want to. That's all he said. You don't have to do it like this no more. God. Nobody had ever told me that. They've been telling me all my life, don't drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot, but they didn't tell me not to, how to live without doing it. That's the answer. See, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. How do you live in a world you don't belong to? That wants no part of you and you don't want any part of, and the only thing that makes it bearable for an instant is something that you put in you. After the meeting, I went up to him. I said, "How do you learn how to live?" He told me about a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, "You go get it. I go and pray that you find some part of you in it." I guess he's prayed real hard, that little fella, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. There is a strange phenomenon that takes place in my life. And it seems like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship, just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Oh, I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I wasn't one. I didn't know what I was. I thought I was a convict. I was a convict and something. And an and. I didn't know what I was. And then I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you confused me as much as anybody else has ever confused me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thoroughly confused sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You would stand at podiums like this, you'd say, "I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful." And I'd say, "I'm not an alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. I'm nuts." I was as physically sober as the guy saying that was. And so my logical explanation to a person with a keen alcoholic mind. Have you ever noticed that alcoholics are the only ones who tell you they have keen alcoholic mind? Nobody else says that. I mean, you ever said one in Model 9 say, oh yeah, he's got a real keen alcoholic mind. Look at that jackass flip-flopping around over there on the floor with his keen alcoholic mind figuring out the world. I'm going to go get that keen alcoholic mind out of jail today. He was so smart he burned a barn down last night. Didn't know what it was. My keen alcoholic mind told me I wasn't alcoholic. But you see, that's the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism tells me I ain't got it. My disease tells me I haven't got it. My body knows it do. My mind says, you ain't got it. You just ain't got it. And then you'd say from things before him, you got to get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got up running around, sick with my head cut off. I emptied ashtrays and poured coffee and smiled at him. And I went back and sit in the corner back there in inventory point and died. I was doing everything they told me to do and I'm dying. I ain't like them. See, I said, I'm not alcoholic. That's a logical explanation. I'm not an alcoholic. If I was an alcoholic, all I would have to do is not drink, pick up them damned ashtrays, and I'd be wonderful, like they are. See? I didn't know. And I read your book. Every time I said to it, just one of you would say, it's in the book. What's in the book? It's in the book. If you just want to kill me, I mean, take your goddamn book. One day I threw it across the room. I'd been reading it in this little cell. I threw it across the room and picked it up and saw the most simple statement I ever seen in my life. It said, how it works. Almost missed that. I guess I was looking for the good fairy. You know him, don't you? He's the one who blesses all these wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wandered through the doors of this magnificent program 20 years ago and put the plug in the jug in my seat in that chair there, and the sweet bird of happiness has been floating around in my life ever since. When he used to get up and go talk, I used to go sit in his chair. I thought maybe that's where he was coming next, because he wasn't coming back there where we were sitting. I mean, you just don't seem to float around back there. Right behind that, it was read here tonight. I don't know how many of you heard it. But the mystery of Alcoholics Anonymous has been taken out of me by attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to everything that happens there. And when I heard the fifth chapter read, the preamble of the fifth chapter, the first paragraph tonight, it was solidified again in my head. Who makes our program? Who doesn't? Why not? No mystery. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. It doesn't say anything about many paths or on the broad highway or our many different programs. It doesn't say that at all. This simple program. And I guess I was just simple enough to understand that because I attempted to work the program for recovery while confined in an institution. And I had a tough time with that deal because I was an alcoholic. I admitted I was an alcoholic sitting in a room with a man taking my fifth step. Prior to that, I was many things, but I was not an alcoholic. I may have thrown it in there once in a while to let you know I was here, but I was different. I was practicing my differences. I heard myself say to this man I was an alcoholic, and with that admission to this very instant, there's a freedom within inside of me that I carry with me wherever I go and whatever I do. I know what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic and anything. I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from a disease called alcoholism. I have symptoms. I'm restless and I'm irritable and I'm discontent. But I have a program of recovery that works on my illness. Anybody can get physically sober. But the disease of alcoholism never rests. Because my disease is getting progressively worse. It's worse now than it was 28 years ago when I came to you. Progressively worse as far as me doing any kind of successful drinking. My disease is not only 28 years worse off, my recovery should be more progressive today than it was 28 years ago when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a line in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that I totally love. It says, it's easy to let up on a spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. It says we're headed for trouble if we do. And that's true. Happened to me. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous have done a fantastic job in my life. What you see standing before you tonight is not what came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have taken me with a large dowry, Chuck used to say. I would, boy, you couldn't have paid you to take me. You couldn't have paid me to take me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want me. But the people of Alcoholics Anonymous just wrapped their arms around me and loved me to death. They told me things like, cussing was a crutch for conversational cripples. They didn't seem to understand that that's the only vocabulary I knew. They didn't laugh or tee-hee or think it was cute. So if you don't like it, just get the hell out of here. Oh. That's what they talked to me. They talked to me. They didn't know I was sensitive. Didn't care. They were more interested in saving my life than they were in hurting my feelings. We seem to be losing some of that. You know, like, I go to a meeting one time, a guy said to me, are you going to talk about God? And I said, yeah. He said, you shouldn't talk about God. You'll run people out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I says, if God will run them out of Alcoholics Anonymous, whiskey will run their rusty butt back in here. Some of us get so spiritual that we're of no earthly use to anybody. We're so wonderful. And it happens to everybody that comes in here. I was talking to a gal the other day that was driving me somewhere in a meeting in Northern California. Picked me up at a plane, was taking me somewhere, and she's 5 years sober, and she was telling some more. In essence, what she was trying to say was she didn't know how any of us, how Alcoholics Anonymous ever survived until she got here. And I told her somewhere between 30 days and 5 years, all alcoholics get dead letter perfect. Just get perfect. We got the answers to questions they ain't ever been asked yet. I don't know how these old fools make it around here. If you just stand aside, we'll show you how this program really works. I don't know what they think we've been doing around here while we were waiting for them. And I wasn't any different. I'll tell you what happened to me. I had three of the greatest giants that Alcoholics Anonymous had ever produced who just took me literally under the wing. I had an old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder who was like a mother to me. And then I had an old man who's dead now by the name of Charlie, who was like a father to me for 25 years. And then I had a sponsor by the name of Norm Alpey who's dead. And I think they all three went to school for hard-hearted sponsors. They were cruel. My sponsor, Norm, just literally was cruel. I came wandering out of that penitentiary on the 4th of June, 1961, to a world I didn't know anything about. I didn't have the slightest idea. My sponsor told me I should go to work. I said, what? Work, W-O-R-K, Johnny. That's the way it's called. I didn't know. I'd never worked. I didn't know how to work. Got me an interview for a job, and a guy wanted some strange thing like a Social Security card. I said, what's that? He said, you don't have a Social Security card, son? I said, no. He said, how old are you? I'm 30. He said, no. I said, never needed one. I never needed one. He said, what have you been doing all these years? He said, you wouldn't understand if I told you. He put me to work. Got me a Social, you know, he took me, I couldn't go to my sponsor and tell him they're not hiring ex-convicts. I mean, I couldn't play that game because the guy hired me and I had to go to work. Then I had to find out what they did when they got paid. You ever watch them, what they do when they get paid? They go to the market with their kids. They put them kids in the baskets backwards and run them up and down the aisle and fill them full of groceries. I used to watch them. I used to stand over there and watch them do that. They'd come running there, and by this time my wife would come back with that little girl I was never supposed to see. So I ran home with this paycheck. I wasn't allowed to drive a car yet. My sponsor told me that I should at least have a driver's license and drive a car. And I said, why? It's because people like me are out there running around. That's why. So I went home and got this wife. I said, let's go to the market. She said, we don't need anything. I said, I don't care. We're going to the market anyhow. That's what they do when they get paid. She said, who? And I said, them. See, she didn't know who they were. If somebody wants to ask you who they are after the meeting, send them to Al-Anon. They really don't know who they are. They really don't know that they are they. We went down and got these groceries. and somebody stole her purse. Isn't that really sad? Somebody stole my first paycheck. You want to hear somebody scream? Listen to a thief when they get stolen from, I'll tell you. There isn't anything more indignant than a thief when somebody gives him a little retaliation. Well, if I could have caught that guy, you'd have another talker here tonight. I'd be up in Folsom telling you that AA don't work. I went back to work that afternoon, got another payment, get paychecks ever since. And then I lapsed into that 5-year syndrome of wonderfulness. That where, you know, when I became more interested in material world than I was in the spiritual world. I became more interested in impressing them out there than I were just being one of you amongst many. Because I'd been in institutional committees and served on committees and been secretaries and made coffee and washed cups and all that kind of stuff. And it was more, now it's time for me to get out there now. And I damn near died because I switched my values from here to there. I became more interested in impressing them than I was just being with you. And it took a tragedy to wake me up. My wife had to commit suicide. And I had to go into a tailspin of living in a $60 a month rented room in East Long Beach, 6 or 7 years sober, working my fingers to the bone, 12, 14, 16 hours a day, paying my debts. Because my sponsor told me I had to pay my debts. Told me I couldn't do this. He said, I made a debt, you pay him. He said, bankrupt is a form of stealing, and you can't do that. And I believed my sponsor, so I did it. One night I was getting ready to leave AA. I went to a meeting where he was talking, and he said, about his wife and kids and all that kind of stuff, and I just irritated me, and I was crazy, and I just got ready to leave. I never been so close to leaving Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And it wasn't that I was inactive. I was going to meetings all the time. I was in institutional committees. I was just crazy. Things weren't going my way. And after the meeting, he came over where I was at, and I was standing there, and I was getting ready to leave. He threw his arms around me, and he said, God must love you a great deal, Johnny. And I didn't feel like God loved me very much. I told him so. He says, yeah, he never gives you any more than you can handle, and those who've got the biggest load surely must be the blessed. I promptly told him I didn't want to be blessed anymore. I've been blessed all I want, Norm. Keep your blessing. And then he said something to me that I haven't figured out, but yet I have figured it out. He said, remember this, my friend, he gives the big crosses to the big horses, he gives little crosses to guys named John. I went home that night and I got in that little $60 a month rented room that I lived in, and I got on my hands and knees and I figured out that I didn't have any cross because I was sober. Had been. I had lived many days out in a world I didn't know anything about with some type of peace and happiness. And because there's a little bump in the highway, that doesn't mean that the whole highway is falling. And I got on my knees and I said a little prayer somewhere I hadn't been for a while because it had become too big to pray. It had become too big to kneel and say this little prayer, God, relieve me from the bondage of self, that I may be a witness to those who receive your undying mercy. And it seemed like to me that from that prayer to this instant, I've been walking toward the sunshine. Well, that doesn't mean that everything is straightened up and done the things it's supposed to do, but everything seems to work in God's time, not my time. I haven't got anything to do about it. Things got along real well. 4, 5, 6 years ago, things started to go to pucky again. You know, I got my ego got all involved in becoming a businessman, successful businessman, so I'm going to open up a big business and become real well. Well, the business went upside down and everything else went upside down. My kids got on drugs and my wife and I got a divorce. It just was crazy. It's just a weird kind of a cycle that just went in there. And it was all big ego things. Just me. I just got all involved. And what I'm trying to tell you was, it wasn't because I wasn't going to meetings. I was going to meetings all the time. I wasn't doing anything differently at Alcoholics Anonymous than I'm doing right here. Just if there's one single little thing that happened in there that really kind of threw it all in a tailspin. Papa got real sick. Real sick. And my sponsor died. Real sick. My sponsor died. I was like a ship wandering around out there without any rudder. I didn't have any direction. I've sober a couple, 20-some years now. I don't need any directions. Come on, baby. I'll let my babies help me. Man, can you imagine that? Huh? Six helping six? I mean, you're going to go, yeah, well, yeah. What did you do when you were 22 years sober, kid, and your sponsor died? Well, read a book, go to meetings. Mm-hmm. I went around and made decisions based on my own emotions. I sit around and meditated and thought about things. You know what happens really when I meditate? I'm associating with lower companions. I'm my lower companion. Me. What makes me seem to think, because I've had a drink of alcohol or smoked any joints or swallowed any pills or stuck any needles in my arm for 28 years, that I'm any more weller than I was 28 years ago? I'm sick. I'm an alcoholic. My disease is 28 years worse off than it was when I came here. As a matter of fact, in a lot of areas, I need more direction today than I did when I came here. In a lot of areas, I need to be more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, not less involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to go out and be diversified by finding another answer to another problem. From time to time, I had people seem to think that they got to go over here to find an answer to a particular problem, and all they've done is weaken this one. It doesn't strengthen anything for me to go over there and give my time to some other nonsensical thing that's a carbon or a very bad imitation of this at the best. And I go on and go on. So I stayed here. And one day I found myself sitting down in Los Angeles talking to a man about a particular hypothetical problem that somebody else seemed to have. You know how you are. You got them big egos. You don't have any problems. You've been sober all this time. You got 9 million babies and just running the world, but you're just dying inside. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and I thought he was going to tell me what an order I can't go through with it. But he did. He took me on board, and we've got a real strong relationship now. And I want to tell you is when I walked out of that room that day, it seemed like somebody lifted a ton of weight off of my shoulders, because I no longer had to be responsible for running my own world or running the world. I had some directions and some guidance in the world from somebody who was doing not what I was doing, but somebody who was doing more than I was doing. It's real simple for me, because I don't know how you are, but you see, I'm realizing as I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous longer and longer and longer how very sick I was when I got here. How very easy it is for my thought process to move in and my ego to take over my entire being. And I get the understanding that I got this and I know what's going on, blah, 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 and it just doesn't work. You know, particularly when you're surrounded by accolades all the time. And people are forever trying to tell you how wonderful you are. Oh, God, how wonderful you are. I have people always tell me, how you doing? I say, I'm better than I deserve. And they say, oh, you're getting what you deserve. And I say, you better hope it ain't right now, pal, I'll tell you that. See, my sponsor doesn't do this. See, I'm one of the type of people who go to 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 meetings a week. Whenever the phone rings and you want me, the answer is, if the date's open, it belongs to you. So that automatically keeps me involved and busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I'm gone on weekends like this. I talk on Wednesdays and Thursdays, leave early Friday, talk and go back Sunday, talk Sunday, Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday, all the way through, blah, 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 blah. One meeting run after another. It'd be really easy for me to call up some of these old fools around here who've got a little sobriety, who think it's time to sit back on their laurels and say to them, do you realize what I'm doing, man, how tired I am, I'm going and doing? I could just hear them say to me, I wouldn't do that if I was you. After all, let the newcomer, I could just hear him. You know what happens when I call my sponsor and tell him about all these business and busy things I do? I haven't got time to talk to you, dummy. I'm on my way to Bakersfield. It'd be real easy for me just to take, as sick as I am, it's real easy for me to say, well, sure, it's time for me to sit back and rest. I can become an elder statesman. I could just show up and bless them once a week and let them know I'm still there. It may be true in some people's case, but you see, when I'm a sick person with a disease like mine, I died doing stuff like that. I almost died doing stuff like that when I was 5 or 6 years sober. I've almost died from time to time in my 20-some years of running around out there in the world, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, with thought processes like that. Really, I really realize how very sick I am. I got to be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's necessary for me to give of myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, period. Not to give of myself to Alcoholics Anonymous and anything else, because I don't have anything else to give to anything else. I get confused too easy. So I stay here. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't know of anybody who lives upon the face of this earth that I would trade places with. You know, I've been all day today not wanting to be anybody else. Not wanting to be anywhere else with anybody else. I'm perfectly happy being with my lovely wife. You know, Debbie and I have been married a little over a year. We got a great life. She just humors me. Take this. It's just really wonderful because our life is Alcoholics Anonymous, and Debbie fits right in there. I've been around friends. The only thing that saddens me today is that I don't know more about this town. I don't remember more about this town when I was here before, because I'd like to know what I did when I was a little boy. But I do realize that my insanity was so involved in there, and I was so selfish and self-centered even back then, that I couldn't remember anything except some tragedy that happened to me. See, because I've never been interested prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't been able to remember anything because I'm so selfish and so self-centered and so self-seeking that the only thing that I remember from my past is when some tragedy has happened to me. Nothing else. That's what people like me are like. That's the only thing I remember in my life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And now my life is spent with joyous memories of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, of this 25 years I spent with Papa, of how I sit on his lap and let him rock me to sleep and teach me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I rode a thousand, thousand miles with my dear departed sponsor, Norm, and listened to him talk and laugh with him and played golf with him and shared this fellowship with him and my years and years of happiness with you. Do you know that I can remember everywhere I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous? In the 20-some years I've been wandering around in this country from border to border, I can remember everywhere I've been. I remember every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever been in, because it's been a joyous, happy occasion in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fantastic thing. Alcoholics Anonymous is. I don't know about anything else, you see, because I haven't been anywhere else. If there is anything else for anybody else, they're more than welcome to it. I don't need it. I have found what they told me it was. When they said to me years ago, when you said to me, it's in the book, what you said to me was this: what it is what I thought it was over here in East Lawrence one day when I took a drink. What it is what I thought it was out there in them city streets in Los Angeles when I smoked my first joint and stuck my first needle in my arm. What it is that's in that book is what I hungered and thirsted and looked for all of my life. And I didn't seem to realize that I had to be beat myself into an absolute state of nothingness to be able to receive this fantastic gift of life. Sobriety and a way of life. And I found it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got it all. And more important than that, I know the answer and where the answer is. And so I surround myself and bury myself, not in the problem, but in the solution. I do not dwell in the problem, because the problem is not important. The solution, to live in the solution, is important. And there was a guy who I loved very much who gave me a little quotation that I love. It's such a joyous thing in my life that I had a plaque made of it hanging over the door of my house. I see it as I go out the door. The problem was that this guy that gave me this little quotation forgot it. He just seemingly forgot it, and he took off running down the street like a wild man after 8 years or 9 years or something. And that little quotation is this, and it's the greatest piece of truth that I know of. It says this: if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. Ain't that heavy? I know it's not much for you folks, but they really eat that stuff up in Bellflower, Lakeland. I call it. They go, oh, wow. But I go over here to KU's up on the hill looking down on us with his education. The reason that means so much to me is because Chuck used to tell me, time and time and time again, the old man used to tell me, as he was rocking me to sleep, you cannot think your way into right living, you got to live your way into right thinking. And what that little quotation was that this guy gave me, you keep doing what you're doing, you keep getting what you're getting, means exactly what it says. That means if you're sitting in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight and you don't want to be here and you'd rather be somewhere else and havoc is raising hell in your life and you got that football in there and you're different and you're strange and you want to be, keep on doing what you're doing. You keep getting what you're getting. But by the same token, if you're sitting in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight and there's some peace in your life and some joyousness in your soul, I suggest that you continue doing what you're doing because you'll surely get what you've been getting. I don't know about you. I really don't know about anybody else who lives upon the face of this earth. But I can tell you that for me, and only for me, I'm going to continue doing what I've been doing because I surely do love what I've been getting. Thank you.